Trying to sing along with our tear-filled song. And we sang that day we shall overcome. We shall overcome. Let me hear you now. Soldier, and a word to the man who's following orders, tried to kill our friend. You are not the enemy, don't be a puppet and a pawn. Regain your dignity and come and stop the bomb. Oh, stop the death train, stop the death train. Because in Nicaragua, Mexico and El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, people want the freedom, not this filthy wars. Freedom to have more than tortillas, freedom to live our own lives. So like Brian and Duncan and Dave, come help us stop the lies, oh, and stop the death train. Come on and stop the death train. Stop, stop, stop the death train. Stop, stop, stop the death train. Who've lost legs and life, blood stained on the tracks that day, and in Central America. But the blood of martyrs is the seed of liberty, and I really do believe of that seed we are the fruit. And as Holly held Brian, that day we came to realize, oh yes, that we had just begun. And we sang that day, today.
for hours. Okay. Back of this truck. Oh, get out of the audio, you idiot. How are you going to prove you were run over by the arming of Yemen? Yes, okay. There we go.
Oh, rats! I can hear when they do that. But you see, there's no explosive placard visible from the front. I had a right to arrest him. That's a violation of California traffic code. You always have a placard visible from the front. Where the cops are going to chase some suspects smack into air bombs. You know how that works.
Indiana, 256-7192, 1013. Dueling cameras, oh boy. Unfortunately, we have to stop.
This is a little bit boring, but this is putting Yemen on the out of service line at the tracks and pushing across the street from the out of Yemen on Syria on the telephone pole at 5300 Port Chicago Highway.
Mm-hmm. Over my dead body, like the Yemenis we're murdering. We are all Afghanis.
Refugees ended up in the Gaza Strip. 1967, the IDF moved in, and the refugees in Gaza became refugees again. Settlers took their farmland, soldiers took the ports, and the people were surrounded by military forts. In 2007, they cut it off completely. No access to the borders, no access to the sea. The world began to see this unavoidable stamp. The most crowded place on earth was now a concentration camp. Israeli jet fighters bombed Gaza from the air, and they kept out the supplies needed to rebuild and repair. They kept out the convoys of humanitarian aid. Anemic children going hungry, crushed and burned in bombing raids from around the world. Good people tried to get across the border to the other side. Almost all of them were turned away, deported back to Turkey, Jordan, France, the USA. They were barred from ever coming back. Adam and Huwaita decided on a different tack. They loaded up a boat and managed to get through. That's when activists in Istanbul decided what to do. Armed with food and wheelchairs and prosthetic limbs for victims of the bombing raids to wear. They packed cement by the ton. They had a few kitchen knives, but not a single gun. They were determined to reach the bay, to break the siege of Gaza and not be turned away. As they left Turkish waters, everybody wished them well. As for what would happen, only the apartheid state could tell. All aboard the Mavi Marmara, sailing toward Goliath's kingdom, armed with nothing but a stone. All aboard the Mavi Marmara, tell the children of Jerusalem, you are not alone. 700 people on board this Turkish ferry, they were 60 miles from the shore, out in the open sea, in international waters, with no plans for turning back. That's when Netanyahu told his soldiers to attack. They came down from helicopters, fired guns from Zodiacs. They shot some people in their heads and shot others in their backs. The captain raised a white flag high into the air. The soldiers kept on shooting beneath the floodlights' glare. The soldiers kept on shooting. It was a free fire zone. So many dead and wounded, just how many is known. So many dead and wounded, blood flowing on the floor. The soldiers kept on shooting 60 miles from the shore. Medics tried to treat the wounded, all they could do was watch them bleed. The soldiers wouldn't let them get the urgent help they needed. Mass troopers held their hostages. The Navy towed the ship just for trying to sail to the little Gaza Strip. All aboard the Mavi Marmara, sailing toward Goliath's kingdom, armed with nothing but a stone. All aboard the Mavi Marmara, tell the children of Jerusalem, you are not alone. Cell phone. This is what Goliath does to those who dare to throw a stone. The ghost of the Exodus is shouting at the sky, but Netanyahu isn't listening. He's just watching people die. For days, nobody knew just what happened on that boat, because everyone was held in jail and dead men do not float. All the world will remember what happened on that night. And to end the siege of Gaza, more will go and join the fight. All aboard the Rachel Corrie, sailing toward Goliath's kingdom, armed with nothing but a stone. All aboard the Rachel Corrie, tell the children of Jerusalem, you are not alone.
Give me a T.
T.
Give me an R.
R.
Give me an E.
E.
Give me an A.
A.
Give me an S.
S.
Give me an O.
O.
Give me an N.
N.
What's that spell?
Treason.
What's that spell?
Treason.
One more time.
Treason.
You're all going to get arrested.
Mm-hmm. My name is John Riley. I'll have your ear only a while. I left my dear home in Ireland. It was death, starvation, or exile. When I got to America, it was my duty to go. Enter the army and slog across Texas to join in the war against Mexico. And it was there in the pueblos and hillsides that I saw the mistake I had made. Part of a conquering army with the morals of a bayonet blade. And there amidst all these poor dying Catholics, screaming children, the burning stench of it all, myself and 200 Irishmen decided to rise to the call. From Dublin City to San Diego, we witnessed freedom denied. So we formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side. We formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side. We marched neath the green flag of St. Patrick, emblazoned with Erin Gobra. Bright with the harp and the shamrock, and Libertad para Mexicana. Just 50 years after Wolf Tone, 5,000 miles away, the Yanks called us a legion of strangers, and they can talk as they may. But from Dublin City to San Diego, we witnessed freedom denied. So we formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side. We formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side. We fought them in Matamoros, where their volunteers were raping the nuns. In Monterrey and Cerro Gordo, we fought on as Ireland's sons. We were the red-headed fighters for freedom amidst these brown-skinned women and men. Side by side we fought against tyranny, and I dare say we'd do it again. From Dublin City to San Diego, we witnessed freedom denied. So we formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side. We formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side. Them in five major battles. Churubusco was the last. Overwhelmed by the cannons from Boston, we fell after each mortar blast. Most of us died on that hillside in the service of the Mexican state. So far from our occupied homeland, we were heroes and victims of fate. From Dublin City to San Diego, we witnessed freedom denied. So we formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side. From Dublin City to San Diego, we witnessed freedom denied. So we formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side. We formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side.
Then I saw some uniformed personnel. I had a little going on inside my chest and stomach. But it's a thrill, actually, to be here because you're all here. And it's like a celebration of a sacred spot and a sacred moment and a sacred campaign. I'm very grateful for the five people that huddled over my body. David Hartso, Jerry Condon, Holly Rowan, Duncan Murphy, this name slips my mind, from Santa Cruz, Steve Brooks. Those five people huddled over me after the Navy ambulance came and left and wouldn't help, delaying my going to a hospital by 17 minutes. And it was those five people that kept my blood and my spirit alive with my brain wide open from a fractured skull and all my legs gone. And so it was pretty amazing that I'm alive. And I'm thankful for that. And thank you for those people that were with me. There were 40 people there that day, in addition to the five that were hovering over my body, and I was thankful for them. I was thankful for waking up in the hospital. I woke up on Saturday, September 5th, and was told there were 8 or 9 or 10,000 people at the tracks, and that was thrilling to know that that was happening. So there's a lot to be grateful for. I've also spent a lot of time in the last 25 years reflecting on lots of different notions and themes that I've been studying and patterns of history, and realizing for myself, at any rate, that being an allegiance to the nation state, or being an obedient citizen of a nation state, is distracting me from being a recovering human being. And so I have discovered that for me, I'm living in an irredeemable culture, but I want to redeem myself with other human beings in new configurations of how we organize ourselves socially and politically all over the world. And that's been a deep reflection and shift in me over the years. That's just a very quick summary of some changes that I've gone through in terms of how to be a human being on the planet that seems to be in sheer madness wherever I look. Waking up every day knowing I live in a country that's bombing multiple peoples in multiple countries. I mean, that's incredible. And for me, I witnessed the bombings in Vietnam. This is what changed me so deeply, and seeing the aftermath of the bomb of the villages. And so I still hear the moaning of the people that weren't immediately killed in the villages. I can still hear the moaning. These are people that are in deep pain. Nobody's coming to their attention or to their concern. And so when I know we're bombing, I kind of viscerally experience this incredible diabolical imposition of suffering on other people. So that's why I've been thrilled about Occupy. I've been thrilled about the notions of an uprising in this country, an uprising that says no more, we're not going to cooperate anymore. We're going to be in non-cooperation as we build a new society from below. Not from above, but from below. So this to me is exciting, just being here with people just at this level, because I call myself a Neolithic conservative because I've been studying Neolithic villages and the model of small food-sufficient communities, and I'm conservative because I believe in preserving values and nature and real meaningful relationships. It's been quite an interesting journey for me to navigate through this culture since I was given the gift of a new life. And so I don't really have any reason not to continue pursuing what I think of as the truth, even if it leads me to places that seem kind of difficult to express to other people, because it's like I think we're at an evolutionary juncture in human history where we have to examine our epistemology, which would be going from being separate from nature to being, we are nature. And if we are nature, we just can't do what we're doing. If we really experience that inside, I consider that a spiritual and an epistemological shift. And I think Concord Naval Weapons Station Nuremberg Actions has had a big part in facilitating that shift in myself. And so I'm just thankful for you all being here. I have no prepared remarks, which is normal for me. I don't ever have anything prepared. And I think time for Holly to come up here and she stopped the bleeding. She was overseeing, as a midwife, she was overseeing the immediate first aid when I'm lying on the tracks. So she was working feverishly to stop my bleeding in those precious moments for 17 minutes before the other ambulance arrived, the one that did take me to the hospital.
I too am a very unprepared speaker, and it's very, very emotional coming here, driving here. We took a wrong turn, everything looks so different. And then I look into some of your eyes that were here that day, or that helped a real occupation happen that went from weeks to months to years. It's really profound, and it's really profound also to have my son Gabriel here, because not only, you know, when you're a family, when one person in the family is hurt, the whole family has repercussions that are a lifetime. And so it was traumatic for us, it was traumatic for my son to watch his brand new stepfather get run over 10 days after we made vows to each other. And the vows we made to each other, though, I would like to say, first I want to say about that, this is the 2012. My son Gabriel and I, we had a great visit at Dolores Park a couple of days ago, and we lay back and we looked at the sky and the clouds, and we talked about how we both felt every year at this anniversary time, how painful it was, and some of the spirals of depression that both of us have experienced over those 25 years. So we made a pact with each other, and I was going to keep it private, but this is what is coming out of my heart, that we would have a completion here, that we would have a healing here of our hearts, for our children to see violence done to their own family. And I just got back from Guatemala, I want to say, and so I'm really way politicized again after being there and not being able to go to one of the northern provinces, way Tenango, where it's the Mayan people are still being killed. So I got off track. Anyway, tracks. Here we are. So I see this as a completion and a place of healing and a stopping point for us all. I really do think there's something about this 2012 thing, not just the Mayans, it's not the end of the world. I feel like this is a time for a beginner, for the beginning, for a new beginning. So that Frankie, where are you? For singing, you know, we have just begun. And that's what I really want to say, is we have just begun. And some of us, like myself, I'm turning 60 in 2 months. And in my little community where I live now in Southwest Florida, I'm an elder, a respected elder, even though you don't see a lot of gray hair. And the youth really needs elders. They need us. And I've said, I'm tired of marching and I'm tired of protesting, and what else can we do? And we had this conversation around the table all day yesterday, pretty much. I think it starts with growing our own food and becoming small communities, you know, and getting back to the land in whatever way we can, getting back with nature. So for me, I've been, I thought I was getting as far away from possible from California by going to Florida, to the hotbed of human trafficking, to the home of the Coalition of the Immokalee Workers, who I work with. What I found is working as a midwife and a nurse, there in Florida was that the mothers and the babies I were visiting, some of them were, most of them that were Guatemalan, y hablo español, porque por eso yo fui, para cuidar ellos, that's why I went to take care of them. I uncovered 5 different cases of human trafficking within a year and a half, of women being trafficked for sex, sold as little children, 13 and 14 year old girls, and ending up in southern Florida and on a farm circuit of workers, sex workers and farm workers, field workers. So I really want to thank all of you. I really want to say I do still have hope. I think the empire is gonna crumble down, and it's crumbling down around us. And so we do need to be, and we are, the change that we want to see in this world, and to not give up. Because every time I thought I was walking away from the peace movement, or from human rights movement, or from women's rights movement, I end up being a Code Pink coordinator in Fort Myers, Florida. So, you know, and a peacemaker for our Occupy movement there. And we do have Occupy in Little Fort Myers. So we are everywhere. Thank you all for being here. I love you with all my heart. I'm so grateful for those of you that brought me here and contributed to Sherry for all your organizing and for putting me up, to Jan, to Brian, to Becky, to David, for all your hospitality and for all of you. I'm just honored to be here. Con cariño.
Little sisters of the sun, lit candles in the rain, fed the world on oats and raisins, candles in the rain, lit the fire to the soul who never knew its friend. Maya Baba lives again, candles in the rain. To be there was to remember, so lay it down again. Oh, lay it down, lay it down, lay it down again. Men can live as brothers, candles in the rain.
reversing these protests, and it includes setting up barricades and closing down roads to control the flow of Palestinians to the old city. Some Palestinians managed to get to the Damascus Gate, where they were greeted by Israeli military forces that were trying to disperse them and keep them from grouping in that area, as that area has been known for popular protests and where most Palestinians organized events against Israeli military presence in the city. Israeli military forces also prevented some journalist crews from filming any incidents at the Damascus Gate. While inside the old city, protesters were also calling against Trump's decision to declare that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. The incidents had left two Palestinians killed today, scores injured. With no end to these protests in sight, Palestinians are planning to organize even more calls to protest tomorrow and in the days to come.
Okay, Mohammed, as always, we appreciate your reporting for us. That's Press TV's Mohammed Hamail, who is speaking to us live from Al-Quds. One of our guests for tonight's discussion is the president of the American Institute for Foreign Policy, Mr. Michael Lane, who is joining us live now from Washington, D.C. Michael, thanks for joining us. What do you make, Michael, of the continuing fallout from Trump's decision on Jerusalem Al-Quds?
Well, it's certainly not unexpected. I think that everyone, including President Trump, understood that emotions run exceedingly high on this particular issue, and that anything he did that would move the status quo in the absence of an agreement between the parties concerned would likely flame those emotions.
And I think be increasing tension and violence, and this is all very predictable. So it's important that people realize that this is very much like Iraq. Let's say when 2003 was upon us and the invasion of Iraq was pending, all of the U.S. politicians were saying that, of course, war was a last resort, that we did not want war, and so on and so forth. But that was always a lie. The intention was to invade Iraq, regardless of the fact of whether they had any weapons of mass destruction, which we know clearly they did not. But what they say publicly, what Trump says or what the U.S. government says publicly, and what is truly being done are two very different things. We can look also to Syria. As an example, the whole policy of Syria is to fracture that entire nation along sectarian lines, sow the seeds of discontent and violence so that the country can ultimately be split, weakened and fractured, balkanized, if you will. Ultimately, that is what they want because Israel wishes to expand. There's something called the Greater Israel Project in which they intend to expand. And in order for them to do that, they have to weaken and fracture the surrounding states so that they will be pliable enough to be able to justify, probably on the back of a false flag operation, incursions into either Lebanon or Syria or other adjoining countries. This is a long-standing plan. Odid Yanan's The Strategy for Israel in the 1980s lays it out very clearly. So what Trump has just announced is consistent with American policy as a whole because the American government is bought and paid for by Israeli interests. AIPAC and the Israeli lobby run the U.S. government. And the last two visits, or three visits, by Netanyahu to the U.S. Congress makes clear that our government, the U.S. government, is nothing but a bunch of puppet traitors who cater to Israeli policy.
Asbella, Riff, Scherf, and I all simultaneously said, no, no. The consulate. Oh, yes. Well, somebody in his house said, why not the embassy here? And no, no, no. All these Mossad guys, no. No, no, no. It's the consulate, not the embassy. Riff, Scherf, and I all simultaneously made. At this point, the embassy would not have known about the operation. It was too politically sensitive to work in a foreign country through the embassy, so it would have been handled by the Shabak or the internal security in the consulate. They gave me until 8 p.m. the next day to call. They sat outside the house for about 10 minutes in a red mid-sized rental car with Quebec Place. Then they left. I knew it was time for me to leave, too. First, if they tried to get me, I didn't want them to do it in front of my family where they would be endangered. And second, I didn't want them to get me. Well, maybe we can go a little more, because this is a big book. Oh, back to Gmail. While both Magal and Meshad were assassinated by the Mossad, of course, the internal machinations leading up to their deaths were dramatically different. First, Magal, concerns about her would have become acute on the desk in Tel Aviv headquarters as the various reports from the field were received, decoded, and analyzed. It became clear that she had gone to the police and could create serious difficulties. The decision to execute Meshad, however, emanated from an ultra-secret internal system involving a formal execution list and requiring the personal approval of the Prime Minister of Israel. Yep. Anyway, you can go Google Flowers for Algernon Palma Yehia Amaria, Mouse Report, Indy Bay, like I did to find that. But a little more pertinent, the body dump, the body count, you know, let's start with Seth Rich, okay?
I find comforting. I grew up on the wrong side of the tracks as a blue-collar girl and a mill rat's daughter, and nothing shook me to sleep at night like the sound of the school through the tracks and walk the tracks back in the 80s in my high heel wood Zodiac boots and latest flavor of involved in trying to advocate for political change for 27 years. And the media has always obfuscated and, you know, kind of manipulated the public opinion. I have never seen anything so ugly and so blatant, in my entire time of being present and paying attention to this. What is currently going on with the Russia fairy tale and the collusion story of you know, Donald Trump and with Russia during the campaign and the election interference is all a made-up story to obfuscate crimes, obfuscate what really happened with the election fraud, and invent narratives to advance war.
So let's be real. Trump is better on Syria than the alternative Democrat, let us say. You know, not, I am certainly not referring to the one who won and had it stolen, Bernie Sanders, but Clinton, who was worse than Obama, okay? But both Trump and Obama had mutinous militaries carrying out mass murders of socialist government officers and employees, and each of those civilians is an internationally protected person. So they had mutinous Pentagon death squads basically operating under their nose, and they can't be faulted precisely for that. You know, their impotence in the face of military attacks by a mutinous Pentagon acting to their right, okay, even though they are evil's trump card, you know, the greater evil is the lesser evil's trump card in this case. He's even named Trump! Ah! But
It's really, really sick. And it's very, very discouraging. Because I'm going to talk a little bit about the Seth Rich story, but we are dealing with you know, we can talk individually to people who have some kind of awareness of how things are really operating from. But until we have people collectively wake up on a much larger, in much larger numbers, we're not really going to be able to reach people on any of these individual given stories, because in order to be able to see a story like Seth Rich or understand the election interference and where it really came from, or understand the motives that are being put forth by everyone on both sides of the political aisle around the lies of election fraud and advancing war, people have to come to a place where they understand that this is where our government is at. This is where our media is at. And it doesn't matter how much logical information, it doesn't matter how objective the information, it doesn't matter the source of the information, it doesn't matter how logical your arguments are. We are dealing with that block. And it is not just that other people have it. We have these blocks. I continually see through this work where my blocks have been, and I'm constantly readjusting to see where my where I'm missing pieces. So if we're going to advocate for political change, you know, we can highlight any one story and use it as a way to expose how the system is really working. But we need to get to some underlying fundamental foundational obstacles that we are facing that are causing us not to be able to move forward and really challenge this in a way that is going to be effective. And people got to be very careful about being like, well, I'm awake, but they're not awake. Because what I see with a lot of people right now, and I've done it myself, so I'm not like trying to cast stones when I say this, is this system is so usurped, so mob-like, so operating within manipulations that are coordinated between neoliberals and neoconservatives, and being controlled by power interests, not affiliated with political parties, but wealth, interest, military, industrial complex, unelected shadow players, that I see so much of our talk around organizing and problem solving targeting the things that are not really causing the obstacles, targeting politicians who are impotent to actually create real policy changes within the system. And instead of trying to look at the obstacles and how power has been usurped and how we can develop a collective plan working together as a people to take our power back, we're talking about how we get the politicians and get different politicians in place, and not even acknowledging that that has been a failed strategy even when we are successful, because when we get progressives in or maybe we may disagree with people on the other side of the aisle who are conservatives, but respect some people on that who have old school ideals around at least trying to adhere to some of the better constitutional premises that this country was founded on. Not that there aren't some really messed up premises within the foundational structure itself. So, you know, we get so caught up in analyzing each story. And we should. We should talk about the story. I'll talk a little bit about Seth Rich in a few minutes. But I think we need to really break it down even further than that and get to a foundational level of why we can't have the real conversations. People understanding the reality of the situation we're in. When I was watching the latest article that came out, and all the headlines, how, you know, the Trump administration was briefed on the Seth Rich story and how they're doing what they always do. They draw these connections. There's no real connection between Trump administration and the Seth Rich story. But if they can, you know, if they can say, do a lawsuit that says that the Trump administration had been briefed and thus they were part of a plan to use this story to plant, all people, Trump has been so effective for obfuscating real crimes, because if you put it in the terms of Donald Trump, or you put it in terms of politicians people don't like, or an administration people don't trust, they don't actually look at any of the underlying data. They're just like, Trump is evil, Trump is bad, we hate Trump, Trump is doing this. And it's so perfect for them to be able to not have to hold accountability. And they've been doing this about everything. They channel everything through Donald Trump and scapegoat Donald Trump for basically what they are all doing. So that's what they've done with the Seth Rich story. Now, you know, we had that article that came out last week after there was a forensic investigation. into the DNC servers, and it basically exposed, it looked like data was uploaded onto DNC servers on the East Coast, and it looks like the goal for that was to friggin' frame Russia, to implicate Russia in something that Russia was not part of. Because the fraud that occurred in the 2016 election was internal. The mass fraud that occurred in the primary campaign was against Bernie Sanders. And I know a lot of people in the election integrity activist community are like, Hillary Clinton, you know, was stolen. Bull friggin' shit. I don't buy that for a minute. Because if you have to look at how power dynamics really work, and Hillary Clinton was backed by the true power interests that pull the strings within the Republican Party. So if you looked at her list of endorsements, which grew by the second over on the Washington Post, you would see the top neoconservatives within the NSA, the Department of Homeland Security, the CIA, and you would see Bush administration officials, Dick Cheney, all the people who had been associated with pulling the strings with election fraud in the past are coming over to endorse the Democrat. So when the power interests of the Republicans are vested in the Democrat, why in the world do you think they would be cheating for the other candidate? And who else would have had the infrastructure in place to do such a kind of cheat after they just did a mass cheat through the friggin' Democratic primary? The whole thing was a fraud. They were flipping votes left and right. They were purging people off the registration rolls. They were caucus cheating before our eyes. It was coup. And so, you know, you see the oh, it's like they cheated Hillary Clinton. Bullshit they did. You saw the exact same thing when I was watching Bernie Sanders' votes. I did a whole Facebook social media thing where we were watching the votes flip in real time, and it would always be the same pattern that we watched. Mathematically impossible, statistically impossible ways of every single time we would watch, Bernie Sanders would come in with these huge, 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 huge leads, and he'd start winning all the counties. And then all of a sudden, there were places where they weren't able to pull it off, or they didn't do it everywhere because they were just targeting certain places that they needed to win. But you'd see all of a sudden the votes would just flip. Counties overwhelming. It's like, oh, all of a sudden these latest votes came in and it filled in for Hillary Clinton, and always filled in for Hillary Clinton in the exact same numbers that it would take for her to just flip the win. So, you know, when you look at what happened with Donald Trump and the popular vote, Donald Trump was ahead 2 million votes on friggin' election night. And then it was only after the fact that it was flipping and flipping, and all of a sudden the numbers went from him to her.